The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, Part 1, by Robert A. Caro. Continued on cassette number 2, side 1. And those who died were luckier than those who were captured. The Comanches were masters of human torture for its own sake. Many hill country families saw with their own eyes, and the rest heard about, the results of Comanche raids. Women impaled on fence posts and burned, men staked out to die under the blazing sun with eyelids removed, or with burning coals heaped on their genitals. Many women captured by the Comanches were raped, and afterward they might be scalped, but left alive, so the Comanches could hold red-hot tomahawks against their naked skulls. Fehrenbach says that there was never to be a single case of a white woman being taken by Southern Plains Indians without rape. For the hill country, the full moon, the Comanche moon, meant terror. Recalling her girlhood, one pioneer woman remembered how people were always on the alert and watching for the red men. If we children went to the spring to get a bucket of water, we watched all the time to see if an Indian came out of the brush or from behind a tree. We lived in constant dread and fear. If the dogs barked, we thought of Indians at once. My mother said she had suffered 1,000 deaths at that place. One night, she recalled, her father saw a light in a nearby valley, and leaving her mother, her brother, and her alone, went to investigate. He didn't come back for a long time, and then the three of them heard the footsteps of several men approaching, and 60 years later she still remembered how they waited to see who would open the door and what their fate would be. Fortunately, it was her father with some white men who had been camped in the valley. But 60 years later she could still remember the agonizing fear we had. And she adds a poignant note. Why men would take their families out in such danger, I can't understand. Nonetheless, whatever the terrors of the land, white men, believing in its promise of wealth, came to claim it. In 1858 there were enough, perhaps 1,000, people along the Blanco and Pedernales rivers and their tributary streams to form a county, Blanco County, after the White Hill Country limestone, and to build a church and a school, in which, along a wall, lay long logs the length of the building to hold the shutters in place in case of Indian attack. And for two men who came to Blanco County in 1858, young Tom and Sam Johnson, it appeared for a while as if the promise would be fulfilled. When, after the Civil War in which both brothers fought, Private Sam Johnson had a horse shot from under him at the Battle of Pleasant Hill. Under fire, he carried a wounded companion from the battlefield. They returned to the hill country. They found that their small herd of cattle had multiplied, as had the cattle left to run wild by other men. Before the war, with prices low and markets and transportation uncertain, cattle had not been valuable. The hills were swarming with steers, longhorns unbranded and free for the taking. Texas law made unbranded stock public property. And now, suddenly, cattle were very valuable. Giant cities were rising in the north, cities hungry for meat, and there was, all at once, a means of getting the meat to the cities, the railroads pushing west. In 1867, the rails reached Abilene, Kansas, and about that same year, lured by rumors of high prices, the price of a cow in Texas was still only $3 or $4, the first drives began to head out of the hill country, east to Austin to get out of the hills, and then north up the Chisholm Trail, across the Red River and up to the Boomtown Railhead on the Kansas Plains. The men who drove those first herds must have wondered, as on their journey of over 1,000 miles they battled stampedes, outlaws, Indians, and hysterical Kansas mobs afraid the cattle were carrying Texas fever, if the trip would be worth it. But when they reached Abilene, they stopped wondering. The price of a longhorn there in 1867 was between $40 and $50. Men who had left penniless returned to the hill country carrying pouches of gold. $40 for $4 steers. $40 for steers you could get for nothing. All you needed was land rich in grass and water to graze your herds on, and the hill country had all the grass and water a man could want. They rounded up the cows in the hills and brought more in from the southern plains, huge herds of them, to graze on that rich hill country grass. The Johnson brothers were among those first trail drivers. In 1867, they bought a ranch on the Pedernales. By 1869, their corrals stretched along the river for miles. By 1870, they were, one of their riders said, the largest individual trail drivers operating in Blanco, Gillespie, Llano, Hayes, Comal, and Kendall counties. During that year, they drove 7,000 longhorns north on the Chisholm Trail to Abilene. Tom led the last drive. On his return from Kansas, one of his cowboys recalled, his saddlebags were full of gold coins. Sitting at a table in the brothers' ramshackle ranch house, he placed the saddlebags and a Colt's revolver on the table and counted out the money. $100,000. Riding beside Sam on those drives was his wife. She was Eliza Bunton, the daughter of Robert Holmes Bunton, the successful Lockhart rancher, and she had the Bunton looks. A relative described her as tall, with patrician bearing, high-bred features, raven hair, piercing black eyes, and magnolia-white skin. And the Bunton pride. She loved to talk of her hero uncle, John Wheeler Bunton, and of other ancestors, a cousin who had been governor of Kentucky, for example, and a brother who was fighting with the Texas Rangers. She admonished her children to be worthy of their glorious heritage. Sam, a dashing, gallant, handsome young man with black hair and soft blue-gray eyes, shaded by long eyelashes, that were characteristic of the Johnsons, married her following the successful drive in 1867 and brought her to the ranch house in the Pedernales. But she refused to stay there. Describing those early cattle drives, one historian writes of the months of grinding 18-hour days in the saddle, the misery of rainstorms and endless dust clouds, the fright of Indian or cattle rustler attack, the sheer terror of a night stampede when lightning sparked across the plains. Few women rode on those early drives. But Eliza rode. One historian says she was the only hill country wife who did. Not only rode, but astride a fleet Kentucky-bred mare that her father had given her, rode out ahead of the herd to scout. "I am the hero of our camp," wrote one of the Johnson's cowboys, Horace M. Hall, in 1871. "Riding out with Mrs. Johnson some 8 miles in advance of the train, I shot a deer." "Gently reared," wrote an historian of Eliza Bunton Johnson, "she took to the frontier life like the heroine she was." It was still the era when the full moon brought terror to the hill country. It was the worst of the era, in fact, for just the year before, while the families in the lonely cabins in the hills raged helplessly at the government in faraway Washington that didn't understand, or understood all too well, some said, however unfounded, suspicion existed in the hill country that Washington was deliberately trying to punish the ex-rebs. The government had withdrawn the troops from its forts. In July 1869, it brought terror to Eliza. A young couple who lived not far from the Johnsons was caught and killed by Comanches. The man who found them could tell that the woman had been scalped while still alive. Sam was one of the men who rode out on the Indians' trail, and while he was gone, and Eliza, alone except for her baby daughter Mary, was drawing water from a spring near her cabin, she saw Comanches riding toward her through the woods. The Indians hadn't noticed her yet. Running to her cabin, she snatched up the baby and crawled down into the root cellar. She closed the trap door, then stuck a stick through a crack in it, and inched a braided rug over the trap door so that it couldn't be seen. As she heard the Indians approaching, she tied a diaper over Mary's mouth. Published accounts say it was an extra diaper, but that is a cleaned-up story. It was the dirty diaper the baby had been wearing, to keep her from making a sound. The Indians burst into the cabin, and as she crouched in the dark, Eliza heard them smashing the wedding gifts she and Sam had brought from Lockhart. Then they went outside, and she heard them stealing horses from the corral and riding away. She didn't come out of the cellar until, after dark, Sam came home. But 1869 was the last year of heavy Comanche raids. Far north of the hill country, in the Comanche homeland, white men were decimating the buffalo, which was food, clothing, and shelter to the Indians, and thus were forcing them to move onto reservations or starve. Not for some years would the hill country be finally freed from the fear of the Comanche moon. The last Indian raid in Blanco County took place in 1875, but beginning in 1870, the raids became noticeably fewer and finally faded away. The Johnson brothers and the other men and women who had settled the land had won it. And then they began to find out about the land. All the time they'd been winning the fight with the Comanches, they had, without knowing it, been engaged in another fight, a fight in which courage didn't count, a fight which they couldn't win. From the first day on which huge herds of cattle had been brought in to graze on that lush hill country grass, the trap had been closing around them. And now, with the Indians gone, and settlement increasing, and the size of the herds increasing too, year by year, it began to close faster. The grass the cattle were eating was the grass that had been holding that thin hill country soil in place and shielding it from the beating rain. The cattle ate the grass, and then there was no longer anything holding or shielding the soil. In that arid climate, grass grew slowly, and as fast as it grew, new herds of cattle ate it. They ate it closer and closer to the ground, ate it right down into the matted turf, the soil's last protection. Then rain came, the heavy pounding hill country thunderstorms. The soil lay naked beneath the pounding of the rain, the soil which lay so precariously on steep hillsides. The soil began to wash away. It washed faster and faster. The hill country storms had always been fierce, but the grass had not only shielded the soil from the rain, but had caught the rain and fed it out slowly, gently down the hillsides into the streams. Now, with less grass to hold it, the rain ran off faster and faster, eating into the soil, cutting gullies into it. And there was so little soil. From one spring to the next, landscape changed. One year a rancher would be looking contentedly at hills covered with grass, green, lush. The next spring he would keep waiting for those hills to turn green, but they stayed brown. Little grass, and that parched and bare soil, showing through. And the next he would suddenly realize that there was white on them, white visible through the brown. Chalky white, limestone white. The bare rock was showing through. Not only was the grass gone, in many places so was the soil in which new grass could grow. Flash floods roared down the gullies now. Men called them gully washers or stump jumpers. They raced down the sheer, slippery limestone hard enough to rip away even tree stumps and carried the soil away faster and faster. Sometimes it happened almost before a man's eyes. One afternoon there would be soil on a hill, soil in which he hoped that next year at least grass would grow and he could graze stock there. Then a thunderstorm. The next morning, when he looked at the hill, he would see a hill of bare white rock. The steep hills went first, of course, but even shallower slopes washed fairly soon. It all happened so fast. That rock was the reality of the hill country. It had taken centuries to disguise it with grass, but it took only a very few years for that disguise to be ripped away. Even on the shallowest slopes on which grass remained, in a very short time, the richness of the land was gone. Then the brush came. Fire had held it back, fire set by lightning and Indians, fire and grass. But now the Indians were gone, and when lightning started a prairie fire, men hurried to put it out, not understanding that it was a friend and not a foe. And what was left of the grass wasn't the tall, strong blue stem and Indian grass, but shorter, delicate strains. So the brush began to move up out of the ravines and off the rocky cliff faces to which it had been confined. It began to creep into the meadows. Small, low, dense shrubs and bushes and stunted trees, catclaw and prickly pear and Spanish dagger, shrub oak and juniper, and mesquite. Mesquite with its lacy leaves so delicate in the sun, and hidden in the earth its monstrous, voracious taproot that reached and reached through thin soil, searching for more and more water and nourishment. Finally, even cedar came, cedar that can grow in the driest, thinnest soil, cedar whose fierce, aggressive roots are strong enough to rip through rock to find moisture, and which therefore can grow where there is no soil, cedar that grows so fast that it seems to gobble up the ground. The brush came first in long tentacles, pushing hesitantly forward into a grassy meadow, and then in a thin line, and then the line became thicker, solid, so that sometimes a rancher could see a mass of rough, ragged, thorny brush moving implacably toward the delicate green of a grassy meadow, and then in huge bites devouring it. Or there would be a meadow that a rancher was sure was safe. No brush anywhere near it, a perfect place for his cattle, if only the grass would come back. And one morning he would suddenly notice one shrub pushing up in it. And even if he pulled it up, its seeds would already be thrown, and the next year there would be a dozen bushes in its place. The early settlers in the hill country couldn't believe how fast the brush spread. In the early days, it seemed to cowboys that, from one year to the next, whole sections of land changed. One year they would be riding untrammeled across open meadows. The next year, in the same meadows, their horses had to step cautiously through scrub a foot or two high. The next year, the scrub was up to a rider's shins as he sat his horse. They called these scrub jungles shinnery, and horses couldn't get through it anymore. When white men first came into the hill country, there was little cedar there. 20 years later, cedar covered whole areas of the country as far as the eye could see. By 1904, a single cedar brake reaching northwest from Austin covered 500 square miles and was growing faster and faster every year. And every acre of brush meant an acre less of grass. At first, it didn't seem to matter so much, because in about 1870, cotton began to be raised in the hill country, and for a few years it prospered, the hill country earth producing a bale or more per acre. A hill country historian writes, "That king cash crop was being sowed wherever there was enough dirt to sprout a seed, wherever their mules could tug a plow, whether in the valleys, in the slopes, or atop the hills." But cotton was worse for this country than cattle, which, through their manure, put back into the soil between 30% and 40% of the nutrients their grazing removed from it. Cotton put back nothing, and as each crop fed upon the soil grew poorer, thinner, more powdery. Cattle ate down the grass, but at least left the roots underneath. The steel blades of the plows used in cotton planting ripped through the roots and killed them. Moreover, cotton was a seasonal crop, and, not knowing the science of crop rotation and continuous cover, no one knew it, of course, until the 1880s. The hill country farmers didn't plant anything in their cotton fields after harvest, which meant that for months of each year, including the entire winter, the land lay naked and defenseless, no roots within it to strengthen it, no grass atop it to shield it. Inevitably, drought came. The land burned beneath the blazing hill country sun, what was left of its nutrients scorching away, what was left of the roots within it starving and shriveling. Winds, those continual hill country breezes that help make the climate so delightful, and the winter northers that come sweeping down off the great plains, blew the soil away in swirls of dust, blew it, as one bitter hill country farmer put it, into the next county, the next region, the next state. And when the heavy hammering rains came, they washed the soil away, down the steep hillsides and along the furrows of the cotton fields, which the farmers all too often cut up and down the slope instead of across it, into the creeks and rivers, cutting gullies in the ground that next rain would make even deeper, so that the rain would run down that land even faster. Water poured down the hillsides and into the creeks in a torrent, and flash floods roared down the creeks' slick limestone beds, sweeping away the fertile land on their banks that was the only truly fertile land in the hill country. The rivers rose, and when they receded, sucked more of the fertile soil back down with them, to run down the Pedernales to the Colorado, down the Colorado to the Gulf. And all the time, in the places too steep for mules to pull a plow, men, remembering the trail drives and pouches of gold, persisted in grazing cattle, who kept eating down the grass as fast as it could grow and faster, leaving nude soil in those places too, to blow and wash away. It had taken centuries to create the richness of the hill country. In 2 decades or 3 after man came into it, the richness was gone. In the early 1870s, the first few years of cotton planting there, an acre produced a bale or more of cotton. By 1890, it took more than 3 acres to produce that bale. By 1900, it took 11 acres. The hill country had been a beautiful trap. It was still beautiful, even more beautiful perhaps, because woods covered so much more of it now, and there were still the river-carved landscapes, the dry climate, the clear blue sky. But it was possible now to see the jaws of the trap. No longer, in fact, was it even necessary to look beneath the surface of the country to see the jaws. On tens of thousands of acres, the reality was visible right on the surface. These acres, hundreds of square miles of the hill country, had once been thickly covered with grass. Now they were covered with what from a distance appeared to be debris. Up close, it became apparent that the debris was actually rocks, from small whitish pebbles to stones the size of fists that littered entire meadows. A farmer might think when he first saw them that these rocks were lying on top of the soil, but if he tried to clear away a portion of the field and dig down, he found that there was no soil, none at all, or at most an inch or two, beneath those rocks. Those rocks were the soil. They were the topmost layer of the limestone of which the hill country was formed. The hill country was down to reality now, and the reality was rock. It was a land of stone. That fact was plain now, and the implications of that fact had become clear. The men who had come into the hill country had hoped to grow rich from the land, or at least to make a living from it. But there were only two ways farmers or ranchers can make a living from land: plow it or graze cattle on it. And if either of those things was done to this land, the land would blow or wash away. The Johnson brothers appear not to have recognized the trap, not to have recognized the reality of the hill country. Their grandiose dreams were nourished and protected by the nature of their occupation. The terms used to describe the cattle explosion were always kingdom or empire, never the cattle business or the cattle industry, Fehrenbach points out. Its grandeur, the herds that stretched as far as the eye could see, the endless drives across the immense empty land, the shower of golden eagles, fed big dreams, and in Abilene the brothers had met, or at least heard about, men who had proved that such dreams could come true, men who had started out as cattle drivers but had become much more, John Chisholm, Charles Goodnight, Richard King, the Rio Grande steamboat captain who had gone into cattle driving not so long before they did, and was now becoming a king indeed, with a ranch that men whispered covered more than 1,000,000 acres. The sun's done riz and the sun's done set, and I ain't off'n the king ranch yet. The Johnson brothers weren't content to be merely cattle drivers. Land in the hill country, which for so long had been free, was beginning to be bought up now, and the Johnson boys, while continuing to graze most of their cattle on land still vacant, bought a lot of it. 640 acres in Blanco County, to add to the 320 they had started with, and then 1,280 acres more, 170 acres in Hays County, and then 533 more. They bought both these tracts in 1870, plunking down in payment $10,925 in gold coins. And then far bigger ranches, unsurveyed and still measured in leagues, in Gillespie County. The most valuable real estate in the hill country was in its leading city, Fredericksburg. The Johnsons bought real estate in Fredericksburg. They even bought a large valuable tract in South Austin. They made a market for almost everything: corn, bacon, labor, and cow ponies, John Speer writes. Labor because the Johnsons needed all the men the hill country could supply for their drives north. By 1871, the Johnson brothers weren't merely the largest trail drivers in the hill country. They were probably the largest landowners, too. To help them run things, they brought in three nephews, Jesse, John, and James Johnson, and a cousin, Richard. Soon Sam and Tom bought a busy mill, the Action Mill in Fredericksburg, and started making plans to open a store. The Johnsons were building an empire up in the hills. But the land was dominant, and while the hill country may have seemed a place of free range and free grass, in the hill country nothing was free. Success, or even survival, in so hard a land demanded a price it was hard to pay. It required an end to everything not germane to the task at hand. It required an end to illusions, to dreams, to flights into the imagination, to all the escapes from reality that comfort men. For in a land so merciless, the faintest romantic tinge to a view of life might result not just in hardship, but in doom. Principles, noble purposes, high aims, these were luxuries that would not be tolerated in a land of rock. Only material considerations counted. The spiritual and intellectual did not. The only art that mattered in the hill country was the art of the possible. Success in such a land required not a partial, but a total sacrifice of idealism. It required not merely pragmatism, but a pragmatism almost terrifying in its absolutely uncompromising starkness. It required a willingness to face the hills head-on in all their grimness, to come to terms with their unyielding reality with a realism just as unyielding. A willingness, in other words, not only to accept sacrifices, but to be as cruel and hard and ruthless as this cruel and hard and ruthless land. Fehrenbach, writing about Texas as a whole, but in words that apply with particular force to the hill country, says that because of the harshness of the pressing realities of the land, inner convictions developed in more rarefied civilizations could not stand unless they were practical. The man who held to a preconceived attitude toward Indians and could not learn the Comanche reality often saw his family killed, or he himself died in his own homestead's ashes. A little noted but obvious fact of the Texas frontier was that some men lived and some families prospered on the edge of Comancheria, while others failed, and chance was not the major determining factor. Eternal vigilance, eternal hardness, was the price of success. A Charles Goodnight could move early onto the far edge of nowhere and hold his new range against all comers. Some men could not. The Johnsons could not. They were, in fact, particularly unsuited to such a land, and not just because they were, in the sense that mattered in the hill country, unrealistic, as, in failing to understand the reality of the land, they grazed their herds on the same meadows every year. Noting that the best adapted Westerner was keenly intelligent and observant, but at the same time highly unintellectual, Fehrenbach points out that table talk, as writer after American writer has recorded, was of crops and cattle, markets and weather, never some remote realm of ideas. Table talk at the Johnsons was quite often of ideas. Sam Johnson, who had 9 children, encouraged them to discuss serious issues at the table for the same reason he encouraged them to play whist, a relative recalls. He encouraged his children to engage in games that required them to think. After dinner, he would often have them engage in impromptu debates. 2 of his 3 sons became teachers. One attended the University of Michigan, possibly the first hill country boy to travel out of Texas for an education. Sam was interested not just in politics, but in government, at a time when few people in the hill country got newspapers, and when those who did got them by freight wagon a week or two late. He subscribed to an Austin Daily and arranged to have it delivered every other day to Weinheimer's general store in the nearby town of Stonewall, even though he had to ford the Pedernales to pick it up. His politics, moreover, were less practical than idealistic. One of his key beliefs was in a tenant purchase program that would enable tenant farmers to buy their farms. Men, he said, should not have to work land they did not own. When asked for details of the program, he was a little vague. Every available description of Samuel Ely Johnson emphasizes his interest in philosophy and theology, not just in the fundamentalist religion of the hill country, but in deeper religious questions. He was a Baptist, but once a minister of a sect called the Christadelphians stopped at the Johnson house, and Sam welcomed the opportunity to debate with him. All through dinner and into the evening, they discussed the Bible. Because the minister raised questions he couldn't answer, Sam arranged for him to debate the local Baptist preacher. And because Sam felt that the Christadelphian had won the debate, he changed his membership to that church. The Johnsons were dreamers. There was a streak of romanticism in them, of extravagance, a gift for the grandiose gesture. When Sam married Eliza, Tom gave his brother's bride a carriage with trappings of silver and, to pull it, a matched span of magnificent Kentucky-born thoroughbreds named Sam Bass and Corrine, a gift not only unheard of in the hill country, but in that country, incredibly expensive. The Johnsons were impractical. Eliza, a Bunton, was not. She was known for the shrewd bargaining with which she sold her eggs, and for repeating the family saying, "Charity begins at home." But her husband and his brother, lulled, no doubt, by the sweep and grandeur of the cattle business and by the ease with which money was made in it, acted as if they couldn't be bothered with mundane details, as if, for example, haggling and bargaining were beneath them. When Tom returned from Abilene in 1870 with the $100,000 in $20 gold double eagles, the men, many of them German businessmen from Fredericksburg, businessmen whose penuriousness is legendary in Texas, who had given the Johnsons their cattle on credit, came in to be paid. The Johnsons took receipts for the money they paid out, but not in a very orderly way. Relates Speer, "They took receipts and soon had a large carpet bag full, and in such a shape that there is no doubt in my mind that a good many beeves were paid for twice, and some of them several times." As Fehrenbach points out, for all the romance of the cattle kingdom, the men who became its barons, the Goodnights and Chisholms and Kings, were above all else businessmen. The Johnson brothers were not. When they had finished paying for the beeves, they had made many people in the hill country happy. Speer notes, $20 gold pieces were about as plentiful as 50-cent pieces are now. But while the Johnsons still had a lot of money left, it was the following month that they paid the $10,000 in gold for the Hays County land, they had less than they had expected to, and not enough when measured against their dreams. They were guilty of wishful thinking. Cowmen in whom wishful thinking was dominant, Fehrenbach says, could not survive. Sam Johnson was, a relative says, a man of great optimism, and his brother apparently shared the trait. Every trail drive was, in a way, a gamble that while you were on the trail, you wouldn't lose your herd to floods or Indians or disease, a gamble that when you reached trail's end, prices would still be high. Eventually, a gambler will lose at least some rolls of the dice, in terms of poker, for the Johnson boys love to play poker, at least some hands. A prudent, practical gambler keeps a reserve to tide him over the inevitable runs of bad luck. The Johnsons were not prudent and practical. They had gambled in 1867 and 1868 and 1869 and 1870 and had won each time. And they seemed to think they could not lose, for they kept nothing back as a hedge against disaster. No matter how successful they were, they bet everything they had on the next year's drive. Each year, the poker-playing Johnsons shoved into the pot their whole pile. After they had finished paying out the gold pieces in 1870, they spent those remaining on land. They owned that land free and clear, but only for a few months, for they wanted more land, much more, and to get it they mortgaged to the hilt what they already owned. To get cattle for the 1871 drives, they bought as many head on credit as they could, promising, as usual, to pay for them on return, and then borrowing $10,000 from 8 Fredericksburg Germans, giving the Action Mill as collateral, to buy more. The brothers had taken 7,000 head north to Abilene in 1870, their biggest year up to that time. In 1871, they assembled in the milling corrals along the Purdon Alice several times 7,000. One of their drivers, Horace Hall, was to say that the Johnson boys have brought up 25 herds this season, the smallest of which was 1,500. They had assembled a fortune on the hoof. They had bet everything they owned and everything they could borrow on another successful year. And in the hill country, that was a bad bet to make. The year 1871 set in cold, sleety, and disagreeable, Speer recounts. There had been only mild winters in the hill country since the Civil War, but now howling northers swept down from the Great Plains one after another. Solid ice 3 inches thick covered the hills. Cattle died. The richness of the land had been going. There had been a warning on July 7, 1869, a flood that, Speer said, did great damage to farms along the creeks and branches. A stagecoach was swept away in the Blanco River. Several passengers were drowned. A mill was washed off the banks and found 2 miles downstream, hanging in a tree. Speer had lived in the hill country for 10 years. This was the first overflow, he said. The Blanco was higher than it had ever been before. He displays a light-hearted attitude. It was really grand to stand off at a safe distance and see the Blanco on a grand tear. But the second overflow came the very next year. Speer didn't laugh this time. He called it terrible. People began to wonder. All the old inhabitants were hunted up and interviewed, but not one of them had ever seen anything like it, Speer wrote, and no one understood its significance. Nonetheless, in 1871, the meadows along the Purdon Alice were no longer so thick with grass to make cattle fat. Spring came, but rain didn't. The hill country had had half a dozen wet years. Now it had drought. The Johnsons' cattle were thin when they set out on the long trail. When the first of the Johnson herds reached the Red River ford that they always used, they found other herds lined up before them for miles. And when they finally got to Abilene, they saw, for miles around the chief shipping points, the stock herded awaiting a chance to sell or ship. From any knoll could be seen thousands of sleek beeves, their branching horns glistening in the sunlight. Over twice as many cattle as in any previous year, 1 million longhorns were driven north from Texas in 1871, and they glutted the market. There was, moreover, a recession in the Northeast, and an end to a railroad rate war which had previously benefited the cattlemen. Prices plummeted. In hopes that prices would rise and that their thin beeves would fatten, the Johnsons bought northern corn and kept their herds off the market. But prices only fell further. Half the cattle brought from Texas in 1871 remained unsold and had to be wintered on the plains of Kansas, Webb states. The Johnsons might have wanted to winter their stock in Kansas, but they couldn't. Their $10,000 note fell due on December 15th. About November 15th, selling at the very bottom of the market, they headed home. The trip home was bleak. Winter had come early that year. "The winds cut a fellow through and through," Horace Hall wrote his mother. Arriving at the Arkansas River, they had a long delay because there were so many other wagons ahead of them waiting for the ferry. Their reception at home was even bleaker, for they were returning to a country that had been depending on them, a country whose prosperity was tied up with theirs. Moreover, in order to make even a token payment on the $10,000 note and keep the mill, they had to default on many of their smaller debts, which, Speer says, was a great loss to the people and destroyed confidence. Some were disposed to say, and no doubt believe, hard things about Tom Johnson, but in justice I will say that while he prospered, no one condemned him. The Johnsons' arrogance, their inability to excuse and explain, to plead for time, made the situation worse. Mortgages were foreclosed, lawsuits begun. The brothers lost the land in Austin, the land in Fredericksburg, the land in Gillespie County measured in leagues, most of the land in Blanco County. And then, after struggling to make a few more token payments on the $10,000 debt, they could make no more, and they lost the mill anyway. They had been building an empire, a single disastrous year, and it was gone. They were reduced to frantic maneuverings. To avoid a court-ordered sale of a tract of land to satisfy a debt, they hurriedly sold it to one of their nephews, James Polk Johnson. On another occasion, a creditor secured a court order to have another tract auctioned by the Blanco County Sheriff on the steps of the county courthouse. However, there were only two bidders, and the land was sold for a fraction of its value to a man who promptly sold it right back to the Johnsons. Trying to recoup, the Johnson brothers put together another, much smaller herd in 1872. Some indication of the distrust in which they were now held is a condition of the credit extended. A lawyer, one Mr. Lewis of Fredericksburg, had to be taken along on the drive. But the drought in 1872 was terrible. The blazing hill country sun seared the grass brown and then burned the soil underneath. It was so thin now, all the way through. Creeks dried up, the Pertinalis ran sluggish and low. So intense was the heat that branding and other roundup activities had to be halted. On July 22nd, Horace Hall wrote his mother that, "It has been so hot that we can do nothing working with the stock, for the flies blow wherever blood is drawn." That summer, the Comanches raided, killing or kidnapping several persons, and running off between 250 and 300 horses, which the Johnsons had been preparing to drive north and sell, a considerable loss since a good cow pony was then worth $80. The precise results of the 1872 drive are not known, but late in that year another lawsuit was filed against the Johnsons, and in 1873 the last of their land in Blanco County was sold by the sheriff on the courthouse steps, this time without any maneuvering. In 1871, Tom Johnson had paid taxes in Blanco County on property worth $16,000. In 1872, on property worth $6,000. In 1873, on property worth $180. He is not listed on any tax roll in 1874 or 1875 or 1876. No detail of his life is available. In 1877, he drowned in the Brazos River in Bosque County. No detail of his death exists either. In the meantime, Sam, whose property in Blanco had been assessed at $15,000 in 1871, had moved out of Blanco, away from the Pertinalis, down to Lockhart on the plains near his father-in-law, Robert Holmes Bunton, and then, after a short stay there, to a small farm near Buda, on a low ridge just on the edge of the hill country. This farm appears, the records are unclear, to have been purchased by his wife with money given her by her father. Sam and Eliza Johnson lived on this farm for 14 years, raising 9 children, trying to live on a reduced scale, running a few score cattle, planting about 100 acres of the farms in cotton, corn, and wheat. But the trap had closed. About this time, Speer writes, it began to be said, the range is broken, played out, and we must now depend on farming. But the land was no longer so good for farming, either. There were good years mixed with the bad, but the trend was inexorable. The Buda farm had once yielded a bale of cotton per acre. By 1879, 4 acres were needed to produce that bale. And by 1879, a bale of cotton wasn't worth nearly as much money as it had been when Sam and Eliza first moved to the farm. 18 cents per pound in 1871, cotton was selling for 10 cents in 1879. In 1879, Sam Johnson sold his crops for $560. $500 for a year's work, for a man who had ridden a trail with pouches of gold. Of the $560, he had to pay a hired hand $200 for help in harvesting. The hill country, meanwhile, was up to its old tricks. 1881 was a good year, and as for 1882, well, that was a year, Speer writes, that reminded him that some years Texas floats in grease. This was emphatically a greasy year. Grass was fine, fruit and most kinds of grain good, and cotton, well, cotton just outdid itself. 1883 was a good year, too, and three good years in a row made men hope. In 1884, Sam and Eliza began selling off parts of their Buddha farm to get money to move back to their beloved mountains. They couldn't raise enough. There was only one thing left to sell, and they sold it, or rather Sam's wife did. Eliza Bunton Johnson, who had kept for 20 years the silver-mounted carriage that had been her wedding present, sold it, and the matched team of Sam Bass and Corrine that she loved, and with the money made a down payment on a 433-acre farm on the Pedernales, near the ranch she and her husband had owned when they were young. They moved there in 1887, just in time for the terrible drought of 1888, the worst drought that anyone in the hill country could remember. Not only the Johnsons had been young when they moved away from the Pedernales, so had the land. When they moved back, it was still fairly good for farming by hill country standards, but its primal richness was gone. As for grazing, it now took several acres to support a single cow. The Johnsons arrived back on the Pedernales poor and lived there almost 30 years, during which they grew poorer. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.